Welcome to Profiles. I'm Steve Sanders. Over the next hour, we'll get to know a distinguished physician and leader in public health, someone fearless of controversy and a passionate advocate for the well-being of children and young people. Dr. Joycelyn Elders, welcome to WFIU's Profiles.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Dr. Elders, half a century ago, Indiana University's Alfred Kinsey ignited a firestorm by writing candidly about human sexuality. Kinsey argued that whatever the morality or whatever people's views were about things like premarital sex or what people did in the bedroom, that knowledge was always preferable to ignorance. You have had a distinguished career as a physician and public servant, yet you're perhaps best known to the public for the hot water you've been in from time to time for your own candor about sexuality, particularly your outspoken advocacy about how young people are educated. Do you ever feel some sort of kinship with Kinsey, like you were both cut from the same cloth?
Well, certainly in many ways I do. Of course, Dr. Kinsey had just really was the first person to really do some very excellent, elegant kind of research to bring it before the people. But we've still not learned to accept or talk about sex. Somehow we do it, but we refuse to talk about it. We don't want to educate our children about it. We want to act like, well, the only time it ever exists is between married couples in the bedroom and only when they're ready to have children. Mm. And we know that that's not true.
As we tape this interview, you're in Bloomington to address a conference of teachers, health and social workers and other professionals, specifically about the needs of gay and lesbian young people. What sorts of special challenges and risks do gay and lesbian youth face today?
Well, the gay and lesbian youth face additional risk in addition to the risk that all adolescents face. We do not really do a very good job of taking care of our young people. The mortality for every age group has decreased very significantly except for our young people. And we know that our young people are exposed to many things like drugs, alcohol, cigarette smoking, high-risk sexual behaviors. And then when we move over to gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender youth, we find that whatever the risks are for our heterosexual youth, usually it's increased 2 to 10-fold or even greater. Mm-hmm. And heterosexual youth have very little access to health care. They have no money. They usually do not have the knowledge. They are afraid to go out and talk with people. And our homosexual youth have even more problems.
Because of social discrimination, lack of knowledge by healthcare providers and teachers about their needs and their lives?
All of that. Plus, you know, if they come out and tell their family, very often they're discriminated against or abused or put out, or made homeless. If they tell their friends, or even if they don't tell their friends, very often they are abused and they're more likely to be beaten up at school, or they may have suffer a lot of verbal abuse. They go to physicians. And then we as physicians don't understand many of the problems that they're facing. And so we don't treat it as serious. You know, we kind of say, well, you'll grow out of this, or you'll get over this, or just don't worry about it. It's going to be all right. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm saying that we've not trained our healthcare professionals, our counselors, our teachers at schools. Many times the teachers allow gay bashing because they are not well trained and they don't understand. Mm-hmm. So we have a huge society of, I would say, ignorance, if you will, about gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender youth. Mm-hmm. And because of our ignorance, well, we end up with all these isms. But, you know, I tell people all the time that ignorance is cured with education. So we could really go out and really begin to educate our communities, our business, our parents, all of us. Well, but, you know, there are a few of us that are stupid, and stupidity last forever. Mm-hmm. So I think that if we could really get everybody, as many as we can, educated, that we would really make a great big difference for somewhere between 6 to 10% of our youth mm-hmm. that we're now writing off.
The title of your talk is Leave No Child Behind. Let's get serious. What does it mean to be truly serious about that goal? We hear that phrase. It's become almost a cliche in politics today. What does it mean to be serious about leaving no child behind?
Well, first of all, I didn't know that was the title of my talk until today. But be that as it may, I'm always talking about children and children's health issues and that we need to support all of our children. You know, whether they're poor, whether they're rich, whether they're gay, lesbian, from educated families, uneducated families, we all have a responsibility, all of our children, and we can't afford to ignore many of our children. And when I say use that phrase, I'm talking about the children that go to school, to their temple of betterment, 53 million of them, every morning, to prepare themselves to take their place in this 21st century. Yet we know that not all those children get an equal opportunity for education. They aren't born equal, but education helps to make us equal. Mm-hmm. Yet we know that many children do not have that same opportunity. Mm-hmm. Many of them will graduate from high school with diplomas that they can't read.
Mm-hmm.
Never being able to matriculate at an institution such as IU.
I read something you'd said that there are too many students who leave high school with shoes that light up when they walk and brains that go dead when they talk.
I think that's exactly right. We spend more money on prison guards than we spend on high school teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as we continue to do that, that says that we are not investing in the most valuable resource that we'll ever have. We know that if we invest, to me, education is an investment. And if we invest in education for our children, that we will reap the benefits in decreased prison costs, mm-hmm. decreased health care, decreased mental and emotional illnesses, decreased drug use, all the things that we sit around and talk about we don't want. Mm-hmm. And yet we refuse to pay for it. We'll build bigger, better prisons and refuse to build good schools.
I want to talk to you a little about your own life experience and how it's shaped your attitudes toward education, your views on other things. You grew up a sharecropper's daughter, the oldest of eight children in Depression-era rural Arkansas. How did these formative experiences, your family picked cotton, raised cotton, how did these formative experiences growing up in rural Arkansas during the Depression shape your life and your outlook?
You know, probably some very good things and some very bad things. The very good things are is that my mom always told us, if you want to get out of the cotton patch, you've got to get something in your head. And I grew up certainly wanting to get out of the cotton patch. She said, always do your best. That's good enough. And I feel I've always tried to do my best. Mm-hmm. Even as Surgeon General and getting fired, I was still, I did it the best way I knew how. Mm-hmm. And I tell people often, if I had it all to do over again, I would do it the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Because I felt very strongly about making a difference for bright young people who really didn't have a chance. And to me, that's what it's all about.
I've read that your father actually opposed the idea of your going away to college, but that your grandmother, his mother, intervened, and that settled that. And that your family picked extra cotton to pay the $3.40 bus fare to send you to Little Rock, where you attended college on a scholarship from the Methodist Church.
That's exactly right. My dad, I don't think he was necessarily totally opposed to my going to college or school, but, you know, they were trying to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, here I had just gotten to the stage where I could really be a real value and a real help to them. And I think and he felt that we didn't have the money.
Mm-hmm.
So how could I, we didn't have money for bus fare.
Mm-hmm.
So how could I afford to be leaving, going to college?
And you were only 15,
And I was only 15. So
mm-hmm.
I think that was where his opposition was. But my grandmother, you know, who was I was named after, my grandma Minnie, she says, oh, you go on, honey. And she says, you have to let your bucket down where you are. And so my grandmother was, you know, even though she had only a third grade education, and she was always very progressive in her ideas mm-hmm. and in her thoughts. And my mom was a wonderful, wonderful woman, but my dad had not wanted me to go to college. You know, she would have just caved in and told me that I couldn't go. Mm-hmm. And well, you know, at 15, it's easy to be told you can't do something. Mm-hmm. So, and my sisters and brothers picked cotton all day. You know, there's not much cotton open in August. Mm-hmm. So that means you aren't going out picking a lot in one spot. You're having to go up and down lots of rows. And I remember my young brother, who was only 5 at the time, was out helping, and we were all just working as hard as we could. And, you know, it was getting late in the evening, and I remember him looking up, and he asked, he says, do we have enough yet? And, you know, that has probably stayed with me almost more than anything else. I felt if my sisters and brothers worked this hard to help me get out of the cotton patch, there will not be a one of them that I will not help if I ever make it. Mm-hmm. And I felt very strongly about that. And 5 of them went on to college. 3 did not. But the 3 that did not were, they've probably done very well. They went and worked in the car industry and mm-hmm. probably made more money than the rest of us. But and they had not, one of them had not done well at school. But the other, one of my sisters was probably the smartest one of us.
I've read that you never saw a doctor, never met a doctor until you were actually away at college. You were at Philander Smith College in Little Rock, and you were 16 when you listened to a doctor, an African-American woman who was a graduate of that college, speak. And although you'd gravitated to science up until then, that was the first doctor you'd ever actually met, and that she was an inspiration to you for your career.
Oh, absolutely. Actually, Dr. Jones, Edith Irby Jones, she was the first black woman to attend the University of Arkansas, first black person to attend the University of Arkansas School of Medicine. She just happened to be a woman. But she came and spoke at our college, and she talked about the difference between the high roads and the low. But I'll never forget, you know, this was the most beautiful woman I felt I'd ever seen, and she spoke very eloquently. And all I could think of is I wanted to be just like her.
Mm-hmm. After college, you joined the Army and then entered the University of Arkansas Medical School yourself on
yes.
the GI Bill. Not only were you the only woman in your class to graduate, you were also the only African American in your class. And this was a time when university facilities were still segregated, the late 50s, early 60s.
Part of that's true. There were 3 women that started with me. One transferred to 2 other women that were white. Mm-hmm. One transferred to Washington University. The other had to drop out a year, but she came back and she repeated. Not repeated. She got sick, and so she finished. The 2 African-American men, they did graduate from medical school with me. So I was the only woman in my medical school class, but there were 2 African-American men who graduated with me.
But what I've read is that the facilities were still segregated and you actually had to eat your lunch in a separate room with cleaning people.
Oh, that's true.
While you were in medical school.
While I was in medical school, you know, the white medical students ate in the main dining room with the nurses and doctors and everyone else. And the black medical students had to eat in the dining room that was reserved for African Americans, that was, you know, primarily cleaning people because there were no doctors mm-hmm. there, very few nurses, or you know, maybe nurses' aides or something. So, and then, you know, we had to eat in that dining room mm-hmm. because they did not allow us to eat in the other dining room.
Yet a few years later, in 1963, you became the chief pediatric resident at the University Medical Center in Little Rock. And this puts you in charge of a staff of mostly or totally white male residents and interns.
That's correct. And, you know, it was a wonderful year, a very hard year. I'll have to give the chairman of the department credit for having really worked very hard to prepare everybody. I didn't know all of this, but to prepare everybody and everything for my becoming the chief resident. And I had 9 of the most wonderful young men, and they were determined. that this was going to succeed, primarily for Dr. Panos, I guess. But, you know, even today, all nine of those young men still call me chief.
And you're still in touch with them.
I'm still in touch with them.
But they actually had to sort of lay the groundwork to prepare people for this idea that a black woman would be their supervisor.
Yes. And I think that that was probably done by the chairman of our department. I don't think he just elected me and I walked in and everything was peachy. I don't think that. Mm-hmm. But it was a wonderful year. But I want you to know, I was there 7 days a week. I did not have a single day off. And I worked very hard. But it was I loved every minute of it.
Your specialty is pediatric endocrinology, the study of glands.
Yes.
For the next two decades after that, you had a very successful career doing extensive research, especially into growth problems and diabetes. Somewhere along the way, you caught the attention of Bill Clinton, who
yes.
ultimately appointed you as director of the State Department of Health in Arkansas when he was governor in 1987. How did you meet future President Clinton, then Governor Clinton?
Yeah. You're talking about, you know, the other thing, why people ask me, how did I get involved in the sexuality issues? As a pediatric endocrinologist, all sexuality issues are referred to the pediatric endocrinologist. You know, whether they're ambiguous genitalia, you know, due to metabolic disorders, mm-hmm. whether they go into puberty too late. And the most common cause of fathers bringing their sons in is because they're 16 or 17 and they haven't gone into puberty, or whether they, you know, go into puberty too early. The most common cause of mothers bringing their daughters in is they're menstruating at 5 or 6. So those were, I took care of all of those children. So obviously I was very concerned. But I met the president while he was a law professor up at the university. Mm. And when he ran, you know, he ran for Congress and then he ran for attorney general. He was mm-hmm. attorney general in the state of Arkansas. And then he ran for governor for 2 years. And then he, you know, he got very relaxed, I would say. And someone else came in and beat him. But then he reformed himself and came back and served as governor there for, oh, I don't know, 8 or 10 years. But he was a wonderful governor.
What were your impressions of him back then? Did you imagine that this is somebody who'd be in the White House just a few years after that?
I never thought about him as being in the White House. But, you know, I always thought that he was the smartest, shrewdest politician that I knew. Mm-hmm. He was just excellent. He remembered everybody. And he was, just, you know, and he wanted to do everything for everybody all the time.
Early in your tenure as director of the State Department of Health, you announced plans to create school-based clinics where students could get contraceptives with their parents' permission. There was an enormous problem of teen pregnancy in Arkansas,
yes.
a higher rate than in the rest of the nation. You write in your autobiography about standing next to Clinton when reporters seized on him, asking him if he approved of this idea after you'd announced it, and you say that based on the way he handled that situation, you realized he'd probably been caught off guard, but that this is a man who, as you put it, knows how to swim in Jell-O. What happened?
Well, that's right. That's exactly what – that was exactly my feeling. You know, we were – all of the agencies was going around talking about what they were going to do for youth at risk. And when they got – you know, everyone it said something. When they got to me, I said I was going to reduce teenage pregnancy. Well, you know, obviously the reporter wanted to know, well, Dr. Elders, how are you going to do that? You know, we had the second highest teenage pregnancy rate in the industrialized world.
Something like 20%.
Yes. And so I said, oh, well, we're going to have school-based clinics and health education. And they asked me, well, was I going to provide condoms at school? Well, see, this had already been an issue, and I wasn't smart enough to realize I was really being set up. I said, well, we aren't going to put them on their lunch plates, but yes. And, well, of course, as I said, I looked over, and the governor's face was beet red, and he was – so then, obviously, they were through – they had heard all they needed to know from this new health director.
And this isn't something you had discussed with the governor up until that point.
Oh, no. We hadn't even talked about anything like that, because when he asked me to be the health director and I said – it finally said yes after kind of some negotiating, well, he called me in the middle of the night and I told him, well, like, he had to get three things done. I had to have a 10% raise. He had to let me run the health department, and I had to maintain my tenured professorship at the university. He called me. He said, oh, Dr. Elders, I got it all done. Will you take it? I said, oh. I said, I told you I would, didn't I? He said, yes, you did. I said, well, I don't want to lie. You know, I was getting all prepared for a conversation. He said, thank you, bye. So we hung up. So we hadn't talked about really very much of any of the issues that we wanted to address. Mm-hmm. But he said, he says, well, Dr. Elders told me what she was about before I asked her to be health director. And I want you to know I support Dr. Elders. So
he recovered rather well.
Oh, extremely well. And it just went on. But from then on, it was good that that happened, because from then on, you know, all the media, the TV and everybody began to talk about the problem of teenage pregnancy. And one of our legislators told me one day, he says, Dr. Elders, we didn't have a problem with teenage pregnancy until you became the health director. Well, but, you know, the problem is nobody ever talked about it. We had a problem, but nobody ever addressed the problem.
Did you see impact during the years that you served as director of the health department in the state, impact on that problem?
Oh, yes, we think we did. The TV stations gave all of their PSAs to talking about teenage pregnancy. We started some school-based clinics. We really promoted health education. The entire health department was out there pushing reducing teenage pregnancy. Mm-hmm. You know, and we had, we had 105 health departments or clinics around the state. So we could really begin to work on it. And most of our health nurses knew the problems and knew the people. So the whole nation is beginning to see a fall. The incidence of teenage pregnancy has dropped something like 30% mm-hmm. in black teenagers since then. But we had a drop even before that. So we started the trend. And I think that probably HIV disease also markedly impacted mm-hmm. what's happening with teenage pregnancy in this country.
I know I've read that in response to criticism about sex education, you've said, well, you know, yes, we have sex education, but we're not going about it right. We do one lecture a year, and you don't just give one lecture a year about math and expect people to learn it from a policy standpoint. It sounds like what you were doing was not just making condoms available to students, but it was a much more comprehensive approach to the issue, mobilizing the media, other state officials, and so forth. Is that a model for the way this kind of thing needs to be done?
I think that if we're going to have health education in schools, we can't go around talking about abstinence only. We've got to have a comprehensive health education program where we not only educate children, we educate the community, we educate business. We all have to be involved, and we need to make services available for young people who feel that they need, if they choose to be sexually active, we have to empower them with the knowledge to make good decisions so that they can be responsible. And then we have to provide whatever we need, condoms or whatever, to prevent the consequence of sex. What we do is go around and feel that we are going to legislate morals and feel that that's going to teach young people to be responsible. We've got to do more than that.
You're in the news again on this topic, having written the foreword to a new book by an author named Judith Levin, titled Harmful to Minors, The Perils of Protecting Kids from Sex. In the introduction, you write about the need to better teach children about sexual ethics and sexual responsibility.
Yes.
Elaborate on that, and how does that fit into this book's core message that as a society, perhaps we're overly paranoid about the idea of kids and sex?
Well, I think we're paranoid about sex, you know, except for our own selves, you know. We refuse to talk about sex. We refuse to even imagine that our young people are sexual beings. And what we do is set them up to be abused because they feel, because of our reaction, they feel that if someone is touching them or doing something to them that's inappropriate, they are afraid to tell us. Because if they come and tell us as parents, we often blame the children. And you know, we allow these things to go on. 26% of our adolescents, our young women, have been sexually abused before the age of 20. 16% of our young men have been sexually abused before the age of 20. We don't say anything about this. We act like it really does not exist. And when you think of all the time, energy, and effort that we spend on things that are going to make far less of an impact than an uneducated or unempowered sexual decision, well, then it makes no sense what we do.
What does it mean to teach young people sexual ethics, as you put it, and sexual responsibility?
Well, I think what it means to me is that we have to start early teaching young people, you know, that their bodies belong to them, that they're really very important people, that nobody has a right to touch them in places that they don't want to be touched, that if they do, they need to tell somebody. And I think that we need to teach our young men that they need to be responsible, that if they are going to go out and have sex, they need to make sure that they're responsible, not just going out having sex with no feeling, and that they should certainly use a latex condom. And I often tell them that the vows of abstinence break far more easily than does latex condoms. So I'm just saying that we've got to teach our children that kind of responsibility, that we need to teach them not just legislate and say no. We need to teach them how to say no. We need to teach them when to say no. And then we say, if you do not choose to be abstinent, we certainly want you to be responsible.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to talking to your time knowing President Clinton. After Clinton was elected president in 1992, he offered you the position shortly after that of Surgeon General, which is sometimes called the nation's top doctor. You were the first African-American and only the second woman ultimately to hold that post, yet you were reluctant to take the job. And in your autobiography, you write about how you warned Clinton that you tended to say what you think. And he said he fully understood that and wanted you for the job anyway.
Well, that's right. I told him, I said, he was still governor at the time we talked to me. I said, Governor, I said, you didn't know much about me when you asked me to be your health director. I said, Mr. President, you know what you're getting. And he said, I know. He said, I want you to do for the nation what you've done for Arkansas. So I didn't feel that I said anything in Washington that was a surprise for the president. I just felt maybe the time wasn't right, the place wasn't right, and somehow, under the circumstances, I was not right.
And there's some feeling about, isn't there, that the job of Surgeon General isn't necessarily all it's cracked up to be. The position actually has a relatively small staff, relatively small official responsibility, yet it can be in the hands of the right person, a great bully pulpit for health issues and health and welfare issues.
I think you're absolutely right. The greatest job of the Surgeon General is to use your bully pulpit to fight for what you feel are the appropriate health care issues for this nation. You know, you're over the Commissioned Corps. You're responsive to the Congress and the president, but you do not serve at the will of the president. It's supposed to be an apolitical job. Well, I can tell you it's certainly not apolitical, but I think that if you really do your job well, then you are out there speaking about all of those unmentionables that we can't speak about. You know, Dr. Perron, the Surgeon General, I think he was under Roosevelt. They didn't even want him to say the word syphilis and gonorrhea on radio because, you can't speak about those unmentionables. Dr. Koop had a very difficult time talk about AIDS.
Very proactive on AIDS.
Very proactive on AIDS.
People in his party.
Absolutely. And he was upsetting lots of people. Mm-hmm. But, I think he stuck to his guns. He felt that regardless of what I personally think about certain issues, it's my job as the Surgeon General to try and protect this country.
Why were you reluctant to take the job?
Well, I was very happy at the job I had in Arkansas as health director. I felt that I was doing some things that was important, and I felt that I could make a difference. Whereas, the Surgeon General's job, as you said, you have a very small staff, about 18 people. You can mobilize lots more to push things through. And, a very small budget. Mm-hmm. And you really probably don't have as much freedom as I really had as health director.
But the Surgeon General gets to wear this spiffy three-star admiral's uniform. What, just briefly, what's the history of that? Why, when we see the Surgeon General on television, do they look like some sort of military officer?
Well, they are a part of a branch of the military, except they aren't. They are the unarmed branch. We don't carry guns, but they are commissioned. They're like commissioned officers. They have a rank exactly the same as Navy, the Navy rank. That's what it's patterned after. And you are in that corps, and you're served and you're promoted up just like any naval officer.
Okay. Both in Arkansas and in Washington, and indeed after you returned to teaching and research after your time in Washington, you've done battle with people who disliked what you said about things like condoms and AIDS and teen pregnancy and the quality of education that our children receive about health and sexuality. Setting aside for a minute the particulars of these issues, what do you believe accounts for the vast difference in worldview, the vast difference in outlook between your perspective as a health professional and the political and religious groups who get stirred up at the kinds of things you say?
Well, I think part of it is related to our puritanical attitudes that's been out there for a very long time. And our religious groups have been teaching and preaching some things they claim that's in the Bible, but when you go look for them, they really aren't there. You know, I think, you know, the things about masturbation, you know, they talk about onanism, and, you know, they don't really tell the real story. But it, you know, it served a purpose, and it's been there for a very long time, and it's just hard to get rid of myths. They keep getting transferred along. You know, we thought that men had very limited number of sperm, so we couldn't waste them. And it was thought that men's sperm, you know, they were little people, and they were just deposited in a woman's womb, and all she was an incubator, that she really had nothing to do with it. And, of course, we carried that forever. We thought that, the reason why they were so bent out of shape about masturbation is they thought that it caused syphilis, gonorrhea, mental illness.
Hair to grow on your hands, that kind of thing.
And this was partly because, we didn't have the germ theory of disease yet. And we didn't have microscopes. But we continued to hang on long after we had microscopes, saying that masturbation will cause you to go blind, cause you to go crazy, cause hair to grow in your hands. You know, all of those things we know to be lies. And we say it's a sin against God because God said, don't spill your seed on the ground. You know, we know the real story behind that, yet we continue to carry on all of these myths.
You yourself, though, have written also about your religious faith. You consider yourself to be a committed Christian.
Yes.
You went to school on a scholarship from the United Methodist Church. So
Yes. There
are differences in views even among religious people, even among Christians about these sorts of issues.
Absolutely. Oh, I think that there is no question about that. But that's partly because, you know, I think the biggest factor that has kept many of these myths going on has been in the religious community, one way or the other. So, it's hard for us to give that up.
Mm-hmm. Are health educators making progress? Do you see, you speak to many groups of public health professionals, teachers, doctors. You're very active on the speaking circuit. Do you see a growing sophistication, or do you see that changing in the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years since you've been active professionally in this role?
Yes, I do. I do feel many changes coming about. I don't know if the changes are because we've had to do some because of HIV disease. You know, I think that's been a big fear. But, you know, to me, what we need to do is turn the fact that it's here, we need to turn that into an opportunity to educate. If we had done what we were supposed to do back in the 30s when we had syphilis and gonorrhea, we would have never had this HIV epidemic that we've gotten because our people would have been much more careful and much more protective of themselves. But I think that we've changed a lot. Many parents, a Kaiser Foundation did a study, and what they found out is that 90%+ of parents wanted their children to have comprehensive health education. And even in our conservative Christian churches, 57% supported their children having condoms at school if they needed them.
I'm curious about what your 15 months in Washington when you were Surgeon General taught you about hardball politics and about the role of the media. And just to preface that, you referred several times to masturbation. The incident that led to your being asked to resign your post involved something you said about masturbation as a sexual outlet for children. That incident, as I go back and read the newspapers and the magazines, that incident was widely characterized as if you were out there campaigning to have schools proactively give lessons to young people about how to gratify themselves. In reality, you'd given a speech at a UN conference on World AIDS Day, and afterwards, one of the conference participants, a doctor, asked you this question, which you answered in a sort of tentative way.
Yes.
And it wasn't until a week and a half later that you'd learned it had become a big flap. I'm just curious what if that was a lesson in hardball politics and what role the how powerful a role the media play and the fear that they can strike all the way up to the level of the White House.
Well, there is no question that the media can play a great role. One media, because the day I gave the speech, there were probably 30 or 40 microphones in front of me. Many media people, not one, said one thing about it. But this one person who went to Washington with me was talking about, they said that he felt that I was going to be a problem for the Democrats because I would answer any question that was asked of me openly and honestly. For an example, my response to the question in regard to masturbation. And we was asked, you know, about the A, B, C, D of AIDS prevention. A for abstinence, B, be faithful, C, use a latex condom, and D, do other things. And so, but I was very surprised that the president asked me to resign over that. But, you know, I felt the president did what he felt he had to do under the circumstances.
And this all happened very quickly. As I read in your autobiography, you were summoned to the office of the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Donna Shalala. That afternoon, you got a call from the White House Chief of Staff. And and then you got a call from the president, and you were sort of run out on a rail within about 12 hours,
it sounds like. Well, less than 12 hours, probably in 3 or 4 hours. All of them happened before noon because they wanted my resignation on Mr. Panetta's desk before 2:30. I guess that was the time the media went in. But the article was coming out in the U.S. News and World Report or whatever the following day. And so I refused to resign when Mr. Panetta asked me, and I told him that I was going to talk with the president because I just I didn't even believe it was happening. So, but then when I talked to the president and he told me he was sorry, you know, he was saying he was sorry, I'm so sorry this happened, but we just can't have any more of this. And so I asked him, I said, well, Mr. President, do you know what I said? He said, yes, they told me. I said, do you know what I said? He said, yes, and I'm sorry, we just can't have. I said, well, thank you, Mr. President.
And what you'd said was the psychiatrist after your speech had asked you whether children being taught about masturbation was a good preventative practice against sexually transmitted disease. And I think I read that the question sort of caught you off guard, but you sort of recovered and said simply, well, yes, perhaps that is something that should be taught for that reason.
You know, we were really talking about AIDS in Africa and every place. And he was wanting to know if masturbation could be a good outlet to prevent the spread of AIDS. And so, you know, and ask if, you know, if we should maybe tell people about it and even talk to children. And so I said that, you know, masturbation was a normal part of human sexuality. And perhaps we should stop lying to children, telling them it's going to cause them to go blind, crazy, and hair to grow in their hands.
Have you spoken with or seen Bill Clinton since then?
Yes.
What's your relationship with him like these days?
I think my relationship with the president is, you know, as good as a relationship can be with the president. I worked for him. We were not bosom buddies or anything of that sort. And so I think it's still very good, and I think he still feels as strongly toward me as he probably ever did.
And you have said on a number of occasions that you harbored no hard feelings toward him, that you thought he had done a lot for you and for your career.
Oh, absolutely. Without Bill Clinton, I would have never been the Surgeon General. I would have never had the opportunity of many of the experiences that I've had. So I have no hard feelings in regard to the president. I would have liked to have been the Surgeon General for 8 years, but if that didn't fit in to where he wanted to go as president, well then, you know, you have to do what you have to do in order to save your presidency.
How much of this do you think had to do with the fact that the speech that you gave and the incident where this happened was December 1st, 1994, less than 1 month after the Republican Party had taken over the Congress, or at least the House of Representatives
yes.
at that point, very famously led by Newt Gingrich. How much do you think the reaction to the incident in which you were involved had to do with the political change that was sweeping Washington at that point? Do you think it would have happened if the speech had been given a month or 2 months earlier under different circumstances politically?
I very much feel that the change that was sweeping Washington, the problems that was going on, you know, within the president's presidency and the political changes that was going on, I felt that the president's reaction was very much influenced by that. I don't know that, but this is just my impression.
Because cultural conservatives would have a much stronger voice
yes.
in the Republican Party and in Washington after that.
Yes. Oh, yes.
After you left the Surgeon General's position, you went back to teaching at the University of Arkansas. You've continued to speak out, not just on some of the issues we've talked about, but on other things.
Yes.
Tobacco use,
yes.
National health care, gun control, education.
Yes. You know, and I really speak out on things that I feel very strongly about because I think most of those things really affect adolescents. I was always very much involved with adolescents. We know the almost 90% of the adolescents who smoke were addicted as teenagers. We know that the most common cause of death for young black males is homicide, black-on-black crime.
Yeah. Usually with a gun.
Usually with a gun.
Firearms.
Most 80% usually with a gun. And, you know, I think we certainly know that HIV is, you know, transmitted in the African-American community, 80% related to dirty needles. And yet our government refuses to support a needle exchange program, saying that, well, that says that we support drug use. Well, the studies have shown that there's no increase in drug use. And so, but what they're saying is we aren't going to do this, so we would rather support death. So I really, and educators, I feel, can make a great big difference. I was just talking to some principals about the importance of, they were discussing the purpose of schools. And, you know, to me, the most important purpose of school is to educate our young people to grow up to be decent human beings and have good relationships. What good is knowing everything about reading, writing, and arithmetic if you aren't physically, emotionally, and psychologically fit?
You've been quoted as saying that we don't leave the teaching of mathematics or of grammar or of other school subjects to parents to be taught at home unless they choose to homeschool. But generally, we believe that those are and should be the province of professionals, of teachers. Yet it's more controversial when you start saying that other issues about health, sexuality, personal behavior, personal morality should be taught by teachers rather than under the control of parents. How do you respond to that, criticism?
You know, I really feel that if we have so many, many dysfunctional parents, and I think parents are doing the very best they can, and yet we still have many problems. I feel that when we have dysfunctional parents, that means that our community has to do more. The only institution we've got where all the children go is at school. And I feel very strongly that we as society have a major responsibility to make sure that all children have an opportunity to grow up healthy, educated, motivated, and to have hope for the future. And the day we refuse to invest in making that happen means that we've already decided that we're going to build bigger, better prisons.
If you were the nation's healthcare czar. We have drug czars and AIDS czars and other czars in Washington. If you were the nation's healthcare czar and could enact your own vision of healthcare in this country, broadly speaking, what would it look like? What would be the main points?
You know, you've asked a very tough question. But the first thing I would do is I would make sure that we had universal access to health care, that everybody had
universal
access.
Health insurance.
Universal health insurance. We make sure that every criminal has a right to a lawyer. Why shouldn't we make sure that all children have a right to a doctor? I would make sure that we had health education in schools from kindergarten through 12th grade so that we could educate people on how to be healthy. We can do more to improve our own health than all of the medical discoveries that's been made in the past 100 years. We spend more than anyone else, any other country, on health care, and yet we rank number 54 in the quality of our health care system. So I would really very much support universal access. I would support comprehensive health education for all, for everybody.
Okay. Specifically on AIDS, that we're now during the time that you were in Washington, 1995, in that period, there was a lot of hope about the AIDS epidemic, the emergence of some new drugs
yes.
that seemed to have a very powerful effect, dramatic declines, at least in this country, in the rate of deaths from AIDS, dramatic reductions starting to be seen because of safe sex programs and so forth in the infection rates. Those are going up again, and there's
yes.
new concern about the ability of the virus to mutate and so forth, specifically about AIDS, since we're now some 20 years into the epidemic, and it's certainly a major issue in the African-American community and among young people. Where are we? What needs to be done on AIDS and HIV that we're not doing?
You know, it's so difficult for me to know exactly what we need to do. But first of all, I think education, education, education. We do not have a vaccine. We do not have a cure. All we've got is really trying to prevent the problem. Whereas I think we've developed a lot of complacency. We thought that we had some drugs, you know, our protease inhibitors that would make a great big difference, and they have. They've extended the life, but as these wear off and as we get more drug resistance, we may begin to see deaths again. So we just because we've gotten better on our drugs does not mean that we should not continue to work very hard to try and prevent this disease. And we can't prevent this disease if we refuse to talk about sex, unless we get a vaccine or unless we develop a cure, because we are sexual beings and just say no will not get it.
I want to talk for the time that we have left about your own life now, since leaving Washington and in more recent years. What's your day-to-day life like? You spend a lot of time still traveling on
yes.
the lecture circuit. You retired, I believe, formally from your teaching position at the University of
yes.
Arkansas a few years ago. What is daily life like for Joyce Lynn Elders these days? You're still active as an advocate and,
yes.
and as passionate as ever, it seems.
Daily life for Joyce Lynn Elders is still very busy. I, as you said, I'm on the lecture circuit, and that varies sometimes from once a week to three or four times in a week. I am also doing some legal consulting work, which is the hardest work I've ever done.
How's that?
What
kind of work?
I'm working with some lawyers that are defending the use of certain drugs, redux, the obesity drugs,
mm-hmm.
both drugs that I've used that I'm familiar with, and I feel very strongly that anybody that's been harmed should be compensated. But I feel that many of the suits and even many of them that are being settled, I feel that that's wrong, because what that does is that means the drug companies will not continue to do high-quality research, will not bring forth new drugs, and we all will suffer for a few greedy lawyers.
Mm-hmm. What types of audiences are you speaking to? Who do you get invitations from, and who do you most enjoy speaking to?
I get most of my invitations from colleges. So college students are the group I most enjoy. I love speaking with them, and they will ask you anything. Yeah, and because they want to know, you know, and it's not crouched in a way that you aren't sure you understand the question.
Mm-hmm.
And then I obviously speak with a lot of AIDS groups. I'm also invited to speak to lots of educators.
Mm-hmm.
And I speak to lots of family planning groups. So it's very, even church groups, you think, well, churches wouldn't invite me to speak. But I've really spoken to many very large, you know, major meetings of church groups,
mm-hmm.
which has been very helpful both for them and me.
You have been very active, very articulate in setting forth policy visions about education, about health, and so forth. Yet you haven't had a lot of direct involvement in politics, at least that I can tell. Why is that? Do you work for candidates? Do you plan to get involved in any way directly in the elections to try to set forth the vision that you have, especially since one could argue that some of the priorities in Washington right now are moving in the opposite direction from what you have advocated?
Well, you know, I think that's true. But I'm 70 years old, so I have no desire to become a politician now. And I'm going to speak the truth as I see it. That does not necessarily mean that it's absolutely true, but it's the truth as I see it. And my mom always told me, she says, the day you see the truth and cease to speak is the day you begin to die. Well, you see, I'm going to be around a very long time because I'm going to always be speaking out. But I don't, you know, it would be very hard to get elected. As a politician, you have to kind of walk in the middle of the road. And, you know, I feel that to bring about change, you have to get off the fence.
A final question. You mentioned your age, that you're approaching 70, you retired a few years ago, but you're still very active in the lecture circuit, still obviously keeping up on all the issues that concern you. Where do you, from what source do you draw the energy, the inspiration that keeps you going, that gets you on a plane at 5:30 in the morning as you were on this particular day to come to Bloomington and be interviewed and give a talk? And what internal resources or internal force keeps you going?
You know, first of all, I really love going. I think it's the groups that I speak to that really keep me rejuvenated. Now, I'd always said that I didn't mind being the lightning rod as long as they would be the thunder behind me. But I think when I'm talking to groups and I see change occurring in our country, regardless, you know, the shortest distance is not always a straight line. Sometimes things go up and they go down. And we have to keep working and pushing for the things that you believe in. And the things I talk about, the things I get up and get on a plane at 5:00 in the morning is about things I believe in. And if you really believe in something, you really don't get tired. You know, you get tired when it's over. You say, oh, gee, I'm worn out. But while you're doing it, you never get tired.
Dr. Joycelyn Elders, thanks very much for being with us on Profiles.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
This has been WFIU's Profiles. For our guest today, Dr. Joycelyn Elders, I'm Steve Sanders. Thanks very much for joining us.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in July of 2002. Christina Kuzmich, producer. The recording engineer and editor was Michael Paskash, Luann Johnson, research assistant. For WFIU, thanks for listening.